Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is identification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
We've been talking about climate change, peak oil on the show for quite some time now, but did you stop and think about how food enters the picture? Wayne Roberts, he's the project coordinator for Toronto Food Policy Council, and he was in Hamilton recently to let us know how much it costs us to eat. Introduced by Karen Burnson, she is a one-woman wonder when it comes to food in Hamilton.
Growing awareness of climate change. It's my understanding that this threat of climate change is highly influenced by our food system. That's what we eat, how we grow it, how we process it, how we ship it, how we store it. And in fact, all of these actions account for about 30% of greenhouse gas emissions on this planet, which is a huge number. And it's not something that we always think of. Sometimes we think of cars, factories, polluting, but the beauty of it is that our food system is one thing that we can, as individuals, exercise some control over to the extent that we can make food choices every day that reflect a concern about climate change and care for our planet. And with that extra knowledge and responsibility, fortunately, comes a lot of joy. Eating locally is a pleasure. And I've enjoyed it more and more the more I do it. From bringing Plan B into the cafe to looking at the Foodland Ontario freshness chart when I'm planning an event that's going to be 6 months down the road, using freshness as my guide. Fresh food, local food, sustainably grown food where you have the opportunity to meet the people who produce it. These are just some of the pleasures of engaging in a local food system. We know farmers markets are thriving here in Hamilton. We, as a city, are well known for our downtown market, and that's one of the things that first attracted me to move here, just the idea that I could get fresh food and shop in this lively environment 4 days of the week, all the year round. But then, as my awareness of environment, sustainability issues grew, I realized that the downtown farmers market is not so much a farmers market. I think as Hamiltonians who are enthusiastic about food, we know that of all the vendors that are there, there's just a handful, barely five vendors who are true local farmers. And I know a lot of us do our best to support those people, and I hope you continue to support the families, the Butchrams. And in order to promote good food, encourage people to eat well, I have to engage with other people in my work life, in my work with the slow food movement. It's all about connecting with people. So there are days when I'm dealing with what's coming in my inbox and working furiously, answering everyone, sending off the answers, and I look at my inbox again and there's another dozen messages. But then I always stop myself and say, isn't this great that I'm overwhelmed by this? There's just so much energy around food. So no, we can't do it in isolation. And I'm also discovering the power of working with people in a way that's surprisingly powerful, even though the digital media, it's so tenuous, it's so out there. But I've established relationships in my life that are surprisingly concrete, despite the fact that they're typed. So I encourage you, use the media. I've discovered the power of Facebook, for example, for talking about events, getting people engaged. And I hope that you'll continue to come to these events. Encourage people who don't really know so much about food security and what it means to us. So bring someone new. It's great to be in a room full of people who sort of get what you're talking about, but it's really important as well to reach the people who might be given the chance to discover something new, a newer way of eating, a newer way of relating to other people in their community. I've had the privilege of introducing a couple of my favorite people. The first person who's going to be speaking is Zhuzhi Fodor. She's a university student here at McMaster who will be graduating. I've constantly been impressed by so many aspects of Zhuzhi's character, her intelligence, her warmth, her eagerness to share, her love of food, and her care for her fellow human beings. And I'm looking forward to the introductory remarks that she'll make tonight. Our main speaker, of course, is Dr. Wayne Roberts of the Toronto Food Policy Council, interim president. I first heard about Wayne at a time in my life when I was sort of waking up to the harsh realities facing us on this planet. I had just read the 1972 amazing book, Diet for a Small Planet, by Francis Moore-LePay. It's a classic. So much is still true, and that's kind of sad. But there's some parts that are still true that are quite good. So I encourage you to pick that up if you can. So that was the eye-opener. But the smack on the head came when I saw a documentary called The End of Suburbia. And I saw that at the Staircase Theater. I guess it would have been January 2005, thereabouts. And I didn't know what that was about. The End of Suburbia, I thought, is that like a punk rock rebellion, anti-mom and dad type film? I had no idea. And at the end of that screening, I sat in a theater smaller than this, but pretty full, and everybody had pretty much the same gobsmacked expression that I had. Nobody could talk because of the enormity that some of us were learning about for the very first time. So as I staggered out of there for months, depressed, upset, wanting to talk to people, people didn't really understand what I was talking about. What do you mean we're going to run out of oil? I remember at the end of that film thinking, oh my God, how are we going to feed ourselves? And so as a beginning chef caterer, I started bringing ideas of sustainability to what I was doing. After that, I think what shook me out of that funk was reading a book that Dr. Roberts had written with Laurie Stahlbrand, who's now president of Local Food Plus, and Rod McRae, and that book is called Real Food for a Change, and that turned everything around for me. It wasn't just dwelling on the problems. It really looked at solutions and pointed out the joy that can be found in those solutions. So it's really my honor and my pleasure to introduce Dr. Roberts to you tonight. But before Wayne speaks, we'll hear from Zhuzhi. So thank you very much.
Hey, thank you, Karen. So my name is Zhuzhi, and I just graduated from McMaster, and I'm currently the coordinator of an OPERG working group called PEAS. So OPERG is the Ontario Public Interest Research Group, and PEAS stands for Promoting Eating Alternatively and Sustainably. But before I got here, I had a question of how to feed a city, notably how to feed a city in a just, sustainable, and healthy way. And where I began asking this question was the Quest Outreach Society in Vancouver's downtown east side. What Quest does is they recover food that would otherwise go to waste, so food that isn't sellable by grocery stores or by Starbucks, send it over to Quest, get a nice big fat tax receipt for doing so, and then Quest resells it to its downtown east side clientele for about a third of the cost. So food that's deemed good enough by Quest goes into the warehouse and then into the storefront, and food that is not deemed good enough goes into a dumpster and is sometimes given a third chance by the binner ladies who would come around back and take some of the produce that they still thought was sellable or eatable. So we went to Vancouver, the trip that I went on to visit Quest, to work at Quest. We went with this idea that we were going to be learning about sustainability and the green movement, which was kind of an odd curricular focus given the human geography of the downtown east side, which is very well known for its drug use, for having one of, if not the highest rate of HIV/AIDS in Canada, and for prostitution. So as an example, the main church in the community, the First United Church, doesn't have a congregation anymore, doesn't have Sunday school classes anymore, but houses residents from the downtown east side during the day, so they're given a place to sleep when they would otherwise be on the streets. So we shifted our conversation throughout the week, talking more so about the social conditions of living in the downtown east side, as opposed to the environmental benefits of what Quest was doing by recapturing and reselling food. But it seemed unnatural. It didn't make sense to move completely away from the environmental considerations of what we were doing, which speaks to this teeter-tottering that we do when we're talking about food, where we're constantly re-navigating or re-switching our focus because there is so much to talk about when we're talking about food. Someone who captures this act of teeter-tottering really well, and the importance of teeter-tottering but not teetering too far, tottering too far, is Mark Winnie, who's the author of Closing the Food Gap. gap, resetting the table in the land of plenty. And what he says is that it's important to remember that because the food system is so diverse and complex, it has many interconnected parts, none of which can be ignored for too long before the system falls out of balance. Focus too intently on hunger and you'll lose sight of its cause. Devote yourself too narrowly to agriculture and you'll forget about the consumer. Care too much about your own food and you'll forsake food justice. There are larger purposes in life when all our common interests come together. So climate change and its bearing on our food system is the common interest around which we've gathered here today. But we can't forget that it's only one of a plethora of interconnected parts of the food system, which must be considered in conjunction with one another and not in isolation from one another. So I was doing some research on climate change, and I found this report by the Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research, which is based in Norwich. And what the report found in terms of the lay public's reaction to communications of climate change is that there is growing concern that the social construction of the issue of climate change and its amplification by normative communication channels may be acting to distance or even remove much of the lay public from a point at which they feel like they can take action. The sparse empirical evidence appears to support this, suggesting that whilst shock may make compulsive news, it may distance individuals from the reality of the risk, thus reducing the likelihood that they will act to mitigate it. Subconsciously, it is assumed that change is impossible, rendering them and us powerless. Thus, paradoxically, whilst climate change ranks fairly high among individual concerns, public response to the problem remains weak. So what they basically found is that this information inundation and the apocalyptic nature of the way in which a lot of communications of climate change or climate change in food are communicated put people into a state of powerlessness or helplessness or hopelessness. But this has been completely contradicted by my experiences being a part of the food community in Hamilton when I returned from Quest and from Vancouver's downtown east side. This was definitely solidified last Thursday at the launch of the Community Food Security Stakeholders Committee meeting, at which people from all different walks of the food system and all different walks of life in Hamilton came together one night for a meeting to talk about their common and their uncommon interests and to start having a dialogue that some of them hadn't had with each other prior to that evening. So I want to share with you are some lessons that I've had from Hamilton on a very global issue at a very local scale, because I have not learned anything about food and climate change from books or from any sort of highly academic setting. It's been from interacting with the food community in this city. So that's what I want to share with you this evening as we launch out into a more global discussion. So food lessons from Hamilton. Food has the unique ability to both divide and unite us. So I've listened to more than one conversation between a conventional and an organic farmer, and they disagree on what the best mode of production is, but they do share a common denominator of pride and passion in what they do and are likewise equally concerned with the viability of the future of farming, the loss of farmland in southern Ontario, and where they're going to find the next set of growing hands to continue their passion with pride. So while there might be division when we're talking about food, I've also seen a lot of unity as people start to find their common interests in the city. Second thing I've learned is that we need to reduce decision-making miles, not just food miles. Food, most of the hype and the fear within the food movement, certainly as it's presented in the mainstream, as the Tyndall report was preluding, is that it's concerned with how far food is traveling. However, it's been reported or researched that transportation accounts for maybe 10% of the energy input into our food system. So then we start talking about methods of production, but that's still only just a proportion of the energy that's being used in our food system. And actually, Dr. Roberts was the first person who tuned me into the fact that it's actually the packaging of our food that accounts for the most energy input into our food system, which is a wonderful example of how we can always be challenging what it is that we think we know about food. But while we're so focused on this physical geography food and our food miles, we're not asking questions like who decides where to buy grocery store food from, who decides how and where it will be packaged, who decides what strains of wheat is grown in Canada, who decides the cost and the access points to food. I can't even begin to imagine what that map would look like if we're mapping how far decisions are being made from one another as opposed to simply where the food is traveling from. What I have seen in Hamilton is a lot of people that are reducing those decision-making miles, so fewer steps are involved in actually getting food to consumers. We see that with the growing farmers markets in the city, which are blossoming all over the place. There's been work on having a Dundas farmers market, a Westdale farmers market. The makers markets have been bringing local food to local people without any sort of middle steps along the way. And coming onto campus this summer will be a McMaster farm stand. So that's a sign of a reduction of decision-making miles. We see it with the success of Tapestry Bistro, which is focused on seasonal and local and ethical sourcing. Again, decision-making miles are being reduced. And as a byproduct, a natural byproduct, food miles are being reduced by reducing how many people and where those decisions are being made. The third lesson, very simply, is that when we say food systems, what we are really referring to are people systems. So very simply, food isn't grown, transported, marketed, or eaten without the inclusion of people. So the current ways in which the food system works can be renegotiated through having all those people come around the table and come into dialogue with one another. That has certainly been seen in Hamilton over the last year that I've been involved in the community. And the last one, and probably most important one and my favorite one, and the one that will make me miss this city a lot, is that the people in Hamilton who have committed themselves to the revision of our food system are among the most passionate, creative, devoted, and inspired people that I have had the pleasure of meeting. So I'm very excited to be here tonight, because every time we do come together and come into dialogue with one another about such a meta issue as food and climate change, I don't see any hopelessness or helplessness or fear. Or apathy. I see a very wonderful, committed group of people that are concerned about revising how we feed ourselves and how we feed each other, and that's what it's all about. So thank you all for being here tonight, and I am very, very pleased to introduce Dr. Wayne Roberts to you.
Well, thanks very much for coming out. Exciting for me to see a new generation of leaders rising up, and I think one of the things that Shuzi said that I'd like to emphasize to you is that we need to reduce the decision-making miles as well as the food miles. And the relationship between food and global warming is just starting to come onto the radar of most people in the last year or so. And it's not only people who are global warming deniers who didn't look for a relationship between food and global warming. The people in the International Panel for Climate Change who really concluded the debate about global warming, make no reference to agriculture. It's the one area in which they have no recommendations for action in the future. And most environmental groups, at least the ones that I've been familiar with, have had very little to say about food. They talk a lot about transportation, a lot about heat and home insulation and the like. But food has really only come on to the agenda in the past few years. So we got a lot of mileage to travel, politically speaking, not necessarily food mile speaking, to try to make up for some lost time. And as Karen pointed out, the general estimate is that about one-third of global warming emissions come from the food system, taken from beginning to end, or as it's sometimes referred to as, from farm to fart. And that is including everything from seeding, fertilizing, producing the food, shipping it, processing it, distributing it, keeping it refrigerated, heating it to eat, putting it in the garbage can and having the garbage can taken somewhere, and all the different contents of the garbage can taken someplace different. So you put that all together, that's one-third of the global warming emissions. And I think the interesting thing about it is that it's humongous as a problem. It's also the most hopeful problem that we face, because what makes food different from other areas where there are pollution or global warming issues involved is that with food, you can not only reduce the damage you can do, that is, you can reduce the amount of plastic you can use, you can reduce the amount of refrigeration, but you're still going to cause some harm in either case. But with food, you can actually move over from the harm to the positive side of the ledger. You can actually, I don't think you can reverse global warming, but you can neutralize it. And so it's one of the few areas in life where we have a chance to really make a significant contribution, not only to reduce harm, but to do something very positive. And so it's regrettable that we're a bit late in getting to food. So what I'd like to do is to introduce you a bit to a methodology about looking at food and global warming. And I hope if you think about it, you would find it with the same methodology might help you understand food and obesity, or food and hunger, or food and economic development, food and job creation, food and ending the recession. If you look at the four key points that I'm going to try to make, I think the same method, not the same information, but the same method would apply to any food problem that you want to think about. My first point about food is that whatever you say about food, it is going to have a big impact. Food is the biggest polluter in the world. It is the biggest employer in the world. It is the biggest employer of child labor in the world. It is also, on the positive side, it is the biggest source of job creation, of new jobs, of jobs for young people. And it is also the biggest potential solar industry in the world. And when we think about solar industries, we're usually thinking of, you know, photovoltaics or something that's going to produce electricity. We don't think that farming was, of course, the quintessential solar industry for many tens of thousands of years. The reason why the impact of food is so huge is that we have a little over 6 billion people in the world, rapidly going towards 9 billion people a year. So if we take it from today's numbers of about 6, and you think of the number of people who only eat one meal a day, which would be about 800 million people, almost a seventh of the world's population. And then there are 1.6 billion people, that is double the number of people who go hungry, who are overweight or obese, and that is they're eating approximately four or five meals, the equivalent of four or five meals a day. So basically you can say everybody, in the average number in the world is three meals a day times 6 billion times 365 days in the year. You multiply those figures out, it's always going to be a big number, whatever way you want to look at it. So that's what makes food so different from other things, is that its impact is just multiplied so many times in so many places every day. One of the areas where this shows up, of course, is in waste. Food waste, the numbers on it are humongous. We can take an extrapolation of what Hamilton's numbers would be from Toronto, I think. So in Toronto, we throw away 1 million coffee cups a day. We throw away 1 million plastic water bottles a day. And I'm assuming that the ratios are probably not any different here. In Ontario, we use 4 billion plastic shopping bags a year that go into the garbage. So just think of if everyone used disposable chopsticks, how many forests are eliminated. So the numbers with food are always huge, and that includes in the field of waste. Again, show the flip side, because this is what I'm interested in, is the power to do harm and the power to do good, which is inherent in food, that we have that choice. I got a call from somebody when I put up on my Facebook site. My daughter put me up on a Facebook site. I became a Facebook enthusiast, and I was happy to hear that Karen took my advice and went on to a Facebook herself. I joined this group to ban the plastic bag in Ontario, and I got a email from a guy who runs a small food box company in Vancouver, which is part of the wonder of modern technology. And he said that in his company, they'd made a move to eliminate plastic bags, and that in his company alone, called Small Potatoes, just a small local delivery operation for local food, they'd eliminated 3 million bags in a year. So one side, 4 billion bags, but the other, one little company with maybe 300-400 customers, and they're eliminating in the area of 3 million plastic bags a year. Our food travels on average, if you take the milk, the cereal, the coffee, the sugar, the banana that you have for breakfast, and you calculate how many miles each molecule of that food traveled, on average, any day, your average molecule has traveled 2,000 miles, which is the basis of an unsustainable food system. There is more energy involved in transporting the food than there is in the food. The food spends longer in a truck than it does in your digestive tract. Not good indicators of a healthy food system. And what makes that possible is packaging for long-distance travel. So we may commute a fair distance. Some of you may even commute from Hamilton to Toronto to work, but your packages commute even further, and they commute even further than the food, because the plastic carton on your organic lettuce from California may start off in Calgary, go down to California, come to the food terminal in Ontario and then be shipped over, as about 20% of the plastic that is picked up in Toronto is shipped to China to be recycled. So it's much more than 2,000 kilometers. One of the facts that we'll be taking a look at is meat, which is implicated in global warming in a number of ways. And I'll point out later that you don't have to be a vegetarian as a result of the information that I'm going to share with you, but you will probably see your way to reducing the amount of meat that you consume. We are a meataholic society. We eat approximately twice as much meat as we need, even if you think we need meat, in terms of our protein and other needs. And it's a very expensive method to obtain protein and other nutrients. And one of the things that is linked with the modern food system is how it made meat, which is traditionally an extremely expensive food to produce. That's why in most food systems, like you had the vegetarian faux restaurant in Shuzi's file, they would use meat as a flavoring for a soup. It was not a main course. It was not the center of the plate, which is what it has become since the 1970s with the rise of McDonald's. And what McDonald's and the fast food industry have succeeded in doing, which has never been done in history before, is to make meat a cheap food. And so that's one of the themes that we need to take into account, is that cheap food has, since the 1970s, and most of the problems that are coming from the food system, the enormous meta problems, to use the phrase, I think, from Karen, is come from the 1970s. There have always been problems with food, but never the meta-embedded ones we've had since the 1970s. In terms of big, there's a big number of people who are employed in the food industry, about 2 billion around the world who are associated with it. There's a huge number of consumers, over 6 billion. They're, ironically, despite the huge number of food producers and the huge number of food customers, there's a very small number of corporations which call the shots. In almost any industry that you care, any sector of the industry you care to look at, there are 4, 5, most 10 companies that dominate the entire sector. 4 companies buy about 90% of the coffee. 3 companies buy about the same percentage of the wheat. So it's an incredibly monopolized and centralized industry. Cargill is one of them. It's a privately owned company about which very little is known. And basically, people who analyze the food system talk about the hourglass, and that the large corporations move into the center of the hourglass. They take that big funnel of farmers, and then there's that big funnel of, or big pool of consumers at the end, and they are right there at the choke points of the system. And where they gather is at the center of major distribution points. So these are huge companies that have a vested interest in a long-distance food system. So here they have Cargill in the Mississippi River, and Bunge, an equally big company, again, focusing on that sort of central choke point between the farmer and the consumer. Among the giants, I think almost everyone has heard of Burger King and McDonald's, but you may not have heard of the names of Sodexo. Anyone heard of Sodexo? Compass, Chartwell, or Aramark. These are companies that have approximately 500,000 employees each around the world and that literally dominate this food service industry. I don't know who has the contract here at McMaster, but I'd almost bet a lot of money that one of those companies that I just named has it. The only university in Canada that has an independent, that is self-operated company is Guelph University. So almost by sheer deduction, if that's the only one, I'm pretty sure McMaster does not have one. So, and again, these are hugely centralized operations. And this is an interesting irony of the food system, which again connects to this power to do good or the power to not do good. And that is the reason why these food service companies have the power they do is that in most of the institutions they serve have another cause for being. That is a university. The focus of the university is on teaching. The focus of a hospital is on operating. And food is a number two. They don't want to deal with those headaches, and so they farm it out. So because they don't regard food as an important part of the university experience, even though that's where students spend an enormous amount of time hanging out. And because food is not considered an important part of the hospital experience, even though we have lots of evidence on how it can help the rate of recovery from an operation, they always farm it out. But all it takes in order to stop the farming out is for people to say, hey, wait a minute, this is too important to contract out. That the way our food system operates is key to the kind of spirit that we want to develop at McMaster. And so we're going to have our own that responds to our needs and not somebody else's. And bingo, it's changed. So this is the miraculous power that exists to transform, which does not exist, I would argue, in the same way in other sectors. Again, on the big sign, and Walmart, of course, is a big operator. Approximately 2% of the North American gross domestic product is controlled by this one firm. When one firm controls 2% of your gross domestic product, that's not a sign of economic health or even distribution. But in terms of cities, and this is just starting to dawn on city planners, that they're beginning to see that food is an important contributor to the shape of the city. We now know that approximately 20% of the miles that are driven within a city are to buy food. That's because more and more food stores are not centered near the neighborhood, but are out in a suburban mall that require a car to get to and sometimes a car to get around inside or some kind of cart. And so Walmart is part of that incredible increase in the number of car miles. And so when you think about the cost of something that is low cost in a Walmart, you have to think that part of that cost is 20% of the car miles driven in the city, 20% of the road repair, 20% of a whole bunch of other things that are associated with it. So again, just to the point of the hugeness of the biggest user by far of water in the world is food. So, you know, if you think in terms of the normal environmental imagination, we think of logging firms, car producers, steel plants as the dirty polluters and the big consumers of product. But in fact, agriculture is always way over and beyond them. So it is the number one user of water, the number one polluter of water in the world. And it's now led to the concept which people are talking about as either embedded water or virtual water. That is, in any given day, you consume about 2,000 times more water in the food that you eat than in the water you drink. Food is, of course, you can't grow food without water. Different kinds of foods require different amounts of water. Low, relatively speaking, for vegetables and grains. High, relatively, for meat. Again, we're getting into this big thing. And of course, when it's big, as you can see here, it has to be transported from someplace else, perhaps up a mountain. So that all takes energy. And again, that's all related to global warming. Food is also the largest cause of deforestation. Okay, not the logging industry, not the lumber industry, but the agricultural industry. This is a picture of Brazil and the rainforest, which is being chopped down literally as we sit here to make room for cattle and for soy. It's also the biggest employer of child labor. And again, just to show you the flip side, some of you may have heard of this group of tomato pickers in the United States called the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, who work in the northern Florida area. And a few years ago, they launched a boycott against Taco Bell, saying that they should pay an increase in the price of tomatoes that would go to the workers who picked the tomatoes, who were generally judged to live in slave-like conditions. And what they asked Taco Bell was to pay 1.5 cents per pound more for their tomatoes. And after a reasonably short boycott of several months, Taco Bell gave in, and they were quickly followed by Burger King and McDonald's. And just last week, Bon Appetit, which is owned by Compass Food in Canada, did the same in the U.S. for their U.S. campuses, a mood which might even extend to Canada someday, who knows. By increasing the price by 1.5 cents per pound, they improved the living conditions of the tomato workers by 70%. Okay, so in other words, one of the things that goes with the big of food is that a very small difference can have a huge impact. So that's to my last point under the big theme, which is use your head and think strategically, and we can do something. Now, when you buy the book from Brian Prince, the No-Nonsense Guide to world food, you will see that the opening chapter is called I Think, Therefore I Can, which is a little play on a famous statement by Descartes. And Obama stole that line from me and formed his own slogan, Yes, We Can, same principle. And the second point about food, then the first point is that it's always, anything you deal with food is big. The second point is anything you deal with food provides an opportunity for empowerment, either individually or in large groups. And that's true for you as an individual citizen, that you can be mindful of how you consume things, and instead of using buying water in plastic containers, you can use your own container and bring your water from home that came from your tap, and thereby save all the water that's being drained out of aquifers and farmland in Ontario, and save all that plastic. Another area where food is unusual, I believe, is the power of symbolic change. This is Mrs. Obama in her garden at the White House, which has probably acquired almost as much media coverage as anything that her husband has done as president on any given day, and has transformed the whole discussion of urban agriculture and gardening in North America and Europe just by the picture of herself and a group of elementary school students who came to the White House to open it up. So there's a power of symbolism and inspiration, because the thing about food is that if you want to change, you can. There's huge numbers of things. If you want to change the heating arrangement in your house, that may be difficult because you may be a tenant, or it may be beyond your ability to move it, or it costs a humongous amount of money to insulate your house, and it's just too big a down payment for you to make, even though it would pay over 10 years' time. So it's very hard to move as an individual on transportation changes or on energy changes, but on food, there's multiple opportunities every day. You can say, you know what, I'm going to buy fair trade coffee. If I can afford a coffee, I can afford fair trade coffee. So therefore, the power of symbolism is all the greater. The power of volunteerism. So I think many people volunteer. This is one from FoodShare, which is an alternative to food banks, and there are also food banks. There's hundreds of places that people can volunteer. As shoppers, there are, of course, many ways that people can operate. One you might call a negative, which is to say to boycott, to refuse to purchase certain goods. Food and boycott have long been closely related. The first major boycott, even before the tea boycott that led to the American Revolution and the Boston Tea Party, was the move of people in, it was just shortly after the Boston Tea Party, is the move of Quakers in England who were opposed to slavery, and took it from there that they would refuse to buy sugar from slave plantations. That led to the birth of the anti-slavery movement and eventually the abolition of slavery in all British colonies. And today the expression of that same impulse comes in what you may call a more positive view. So we change from, here's some non-embedded water. There's boycott, which is to say I'm refusing to buy this product, and then the opposite of that is called boycott. I will go out of my way to buy a product that I think is a good one. I will shop at a small local bookstore instead of supporting the big chain bookstore, for example. And fair trade in food is the most pronounced form of that. And most of you would know fair trade in food from coffee, to some extent tea. Chocolate is increasingly becoming a fair trade. Chocolate employs directly and through families 25 million people in the world. Chocolate is the same number. Many of those, are, especially in chocolate, are children who work in virtually slave-like conditions. So a lot of people think, if I can afford a little bit of a treat like this, I can afford to pay a few cents more. And again, as in the tomato workers, a very small increase per pound leads to almost qualitative difference. People can shop at farmers' markets and, again, exercise their consumer power. And an area that's just beginning to be explored is the power of universities. So there's an excellent book that some of you who are university students might be interested in called Planet U by Michael McGonigal. and I can't remember his co-author's name. And the argument of this book is that if you pool the economic power of North American universities together, they are the 26th biggest economy in the world. Okay, so some of you may remember about a little over a month ago, we had the G20 meet, that is the 20 biggest economic powers. The universities of North America almost could have made that meeting as the 26th biggest power. It's an incredible economic muscle that can be used for good or ill, and which is much more than many other aspects of the economy, somewhat under the control of large numbers of young people who go to university. And so that's the purpose of the book, Planet U, is to show here's how university students and faculty could use their power for enormous good. An example of that is Local Food Plus, which on behalf of being transparent in terms of my own relations, run by my wife, Lori Stahlbrand. And it is a nonprofit that is set up to bring farmers who are producing at a significant scale, that is, can supply a cafeteria for 1,000 people 7 days a week, 45 weeks a year, with large-scale purchasers in universities. So the first contract was at the University of Toronto, which is now almost entirely moved over to Local Food Plus. And it's not organic, but it is close to organic in terms of the chemicals that are allowed and beyond organic in terms of labor standards, animal treatment standards, and the like. It is the largest local and sustainable food purchasing contract in the world. And I believe that Hamilton is about, McMaster is about to follow at that at one of its dining situations. So this is a movement that is beginning to spread. When you work on this model of local and sustainable, you're hitting several things at the same time. One is you're reducing the amount of distance. So let's say for the sake of argument that most of the food which is considered local is Ontario, is coming from southern Ontario, probably within 150 miles of Hamilton or Toronto. So you're reducing the mileage from 2,000 to 150, which is a big whack out of the mileage. And even more significant, the farming practices are actually responsible for more energy than the distance. If you look at the amount of food, how energy is spent in the food system, about 14% of it is spent in transportation. 21% of it is spent in food production. That is fertilizer, which is mainly made from natural gas, pesticides, mainly made from petrochemicals, tractors, which require a lot of energy to run, and the like. Excuse me. So when you're moving towards local and sustainable, you're knocking off both of those. The third source of energy in the food system, the big 800-pound gorilla, is refrigeration, which is responsible for 40%. So when you reduce transport the distance, you're also working at that a fair amount. So this is a big new trend across North America and Europe, and I think it's going to be a very powerful factor, and it's going to give a pretty good example of how dramatically the global warming impact can be reduced. Just want to say that related to the recession, almost one of the interesting things about food is how incredibly job-intensive it is. In the city of Toronto, which I work for in the public health department, but we work with the economic development department quite a bit, it's considered that for every dollar spent on a local farmer, there is $5 in employment of local processors and distributors. So it's a huge whack of money that goes to job creation in a wide variety. And as you enter into the workforce, I believe you'll find more and more food-related occupations, not all directly connected to food preparation and distribution, but some to food education, which you see here. Just to let you know, this is a long-established tradition of organizing around food, and one of the greatest and best-known of the food organizers of the last 100 years is Gandhi, who led the movement for Indian independence. And it began in 1926 with a march to the ocean to reclaim salt. Okay, so the British had said, you only get salt if you pay a tax to Britain, which is where the term salt tax comes from. And he said, why do we pay any tax to the Brits? All we have to do is go to the ocean, get the salt water, let the water evaporate, and we got the salt. We can bypass England entirely. And so this is where he got his ideas, expressed in the most famous of his slogans, is to be the change you wish to see. And food is an area where that can be expressed. I believe the Sandinistas, who I was lucky enough to tour several of their villages and work with them on some fair trade chocolate and coffee earlier this year, are the first food revolution in the world. As you can see, it's mainly a female-led revolution, as many things associated with food are. And they began their revolution in 1994, the beginning of the North American free trade. And their slogan was, because they saw the free trade as destroying their historic crop of corn, is no country without corn, no corn without country. So it's very much a food-inspired change. So number one, whatever happens to food is big. Number two, whatever happens to food can be empowering for individuals and for communities. Number three, whatever happens to food that is good will have many goods, not just one. And so breastfeeding is one example of that. Very good for the baby's physical health, particularly brain development, and protection, immunity from in later ear and lung infections. Very good for the baby's mental health in terms of bonding with the mom. Very good for the mother's health, much lower rates of breast cancer among women who breastfeed. Very good for the environment. No need to travel to Shoppers Drug Mart at 2 in the morning to find it. There are two locations conveniently located. And no plastic bottles, no things to throw out in the garbage or anything like that. So in other words, there's health, physical health, mental health, and environmental benefits. So the nice thing about food, the world is so constructed that if it does one thing that is good, it in all likelihood will do at least one other thing that is good. Green roofs, a big deal in Toronto. There is a motion before an important council committee in the City of Toronto on making green roofs compulsory for all high-rises over a certain size, about five stories. And so here's an old-fashioned kind of green roof, which many of you may have seen in pictures of Europe. And so you see how this system works, and here's how it works. It works in exactly the same way in the City of Toronto, only without slopes. It's on flat roofs. 1/6 of the area of almost every city is flat roofs. So when you, any kind of growing medium over top of it, when it rains, the rain stays on the roof instead of falling down into the sewage system, causing a flash flood, which is what saves the city money. And according to Central Mortgage and Housing, green roofs pay for themselves just in that alone before you get any other saving. But the first other saving to come will be obvious in Toronto this summer, which is after it rains and the rain stays up there and helps, let's say, grass grow. On a hot day, that grass, the water will evaporate and cools the area nearby by 5 degrees, thereby reducing the air conditioning bill. So, again, multiple savings. And the food that is grown on a green roof is, in essence, free because it's already been paid for by keeping the water out of the system. So all these technologies are doable. They are all incredibly job-rich. They save cities money in very short periods of time, and they're good for local food and reducing the mileage of food. So as a consequence, food is a positive energy zone. That's why the two speakers who preceded me are positive and chirpy and happy and all those kinds of things which are not normally associated with environmentalists. So part of what comes out of that concept of multiple benefits, or what economists sometimes refer to as elegance, the elegance of environmental solutions, is a positive, upbeat attitude, but part of it is an orientation which, to use a person who said it but didn't practice it, Mao Zedong from China, let a thousand flowers bloom. So Karen was talking to me about her experiences at the Slow Food Conference in Toronto, and sometimes people are worried that maybe this movement is too elitist, and then they say, but then there's another good side. Like, we're part of a overall movement that's going to have many people from many different inspirations. Some people may only be interested in green roofs because it saves the city sewage expansion, and some may be because they want a place to hang out on their roof and it's private. People are going to be coming at this issue for hundreds of reasons. It's going to be a big tent movement. We can bring local organic, local conventional together, and they can work out their problems over a longer period of time. And that gives the environmental movement an opportunity to act as a bridge over troubled waters, that instead of being a divisive force, which in many cases it has been, I'm not blaming anybody for that, it's just a fact that the environment has been a divisive issue, but I believe with food and around global warming, because there are so many benefits to the economy, community development, personal well-being, personal health, that environmentalists can play a different kind of role, which is a bridging role. My fourth point, and then we'll throw it open for discussion, is that food, so the first one is whatever happens to food is big. Second is whatever happens with food has a likely outcome related to empowerment. Third is it's going to have multiple beneficiaries. And fourth is we don't know exactly what's going to happen. The outcome is not preordained. So it's like writing a draft of an essay for one of your university or other courses. You don't necessarily know when you start, where you're going to end, or you may know where you're going to end or think you do, but when you get to the middle, you figure out you got to go in a different direction. So there's a constant feedback between what you hope to achieve. You get your head kicked in by reality, and then you try another way. And so that's the nature of progress in the food movement. People who go for short, quick, fast solutions generally end up in some kind of very disappointing scenario. So we know the outcome of fad diets is that people lose weight very quickly and then they gain it back even more quickly and are usually way more at the end of their diet experience than they did at the beginning. So dieting is not the way to go about losing weight. In North America, by the way, we spend more on diet than the entire gross domestic product of Ireland, $400 billion a year, in a world in which hunger is widespread. So the food area is dominated by people who are promising quick cures to all sorts of things, including losing 25 pounds by having a good dump. And if you walk in a supermarket, by the way, you will see that constipation is the number one personal aggravation, if not health issue, in this country. And of course, the beauty of the supermarket is that one aisle has the products which cause constipation and the other aisle has the products that solve the constipation. So basically, it's an industry that has you coming and going. And that's the way the food industry operates. And quick fixes are not a solution to it. I'm a great admirer of the book, The 100-Mile Diet, for many reasons. They're excellent writers, lots of fun. But and what they understood was in order to get a message across, you got to have a round number. Like they didn't say it's the 134-kilometer diet. And they understood North Americans so perfectly that they understood the only way North Americans understand food is in a diet. They don't say it's a 100-mile lifestyle or a 100-mile opportunity. It's the 100-mile diet. And as a way of writing a book, in my opinion, it's a brilliant way to write a book because it grabs you and because it creates drama. Are they going to be able to make through another day on dandelion leaves or something like that? But as a way of analyzing the problem of global warming or energy use or any of those kind of problems, in my opinion, it's quite misleading because the issue is not the distance that the food has traveled, but the energy that is required to move it. And those are not the same thing. For instance, it could go 100 kilometers by airplane or 4,000 kilometers by boat or train, and the longer distance would have less embodied energy, right? It could be from a short distance but require refrigeration, or a long distance, let's say from Saskatchewan to Europe with grain, and require no refrigeration and only slow-moving vehicles by train or by boat. So the 100 miles doesn't measure anything but the mileage. And moreover, 100 miles, let's say, from Barrie to Hamilton or Barrie to Toronto in small pickup trucks for a farmer's market would probably, to serve 10,000 people, require more energy than the same amount of food in a tractor-trailer truck from California, one tractor-trailer truck from California to Toronto. So it can be, I'm not arguing against their book or the basic premises of it, but the concept of the 100-mile diet can be misleading and put us in the wrong direction. So it's a problem with food that we're easily captured by very simplistic promises. One of the ones that's commonly raised, of course, is the question of meat. Here we have probably one of the most inspiring figures in North America, Mr. Trump, and he's showing his normal dinner on a Sunday night, and most North Americans think food is the center of the plate, and there's a little veggie. You can see it on the side there, or the front, and that's the proper amount of veggies to go with a minor amount of meat. So there is no doubt of, there's no doubt about it that meat is a major source of pollution and global warming. And the reason for that is fairly, there are several reasons for it, all of which are pretty simple to understand. One is it takes a lot of grain, usually corn, which requires a lot of fossil fuel to grow. Takes a lot of grain to produce a little bit of meat. So in the case of beef, it takes approximately 15 miles of pounds of grain to produce 1 pound of beef. That's because a lot of it gets pooed out. A lot of it becomes hoof and tail and hide. And you put it all together. That is a very expensive way to spend 15 pounds of grain, which has got a lot of protein in it too, right? So some people have made that fact into the basis of both an ethical critique that people in the rich world should not be sacrificing all that wheat at a time when there is hunger for their meat habit. And from a point of view of global warming, that's an awful lot of energy to move as an input to get a relatively small amount of energy as the output. So on top of that, meat is a product which requires a lot of energy to store and move. So a lot of people have argued, and I believe their information is fundamentally unchallengeable, that eating, the North American 3 meals of meat a day is about the same as driving a Hummer. You're in the same moral category. And that is true. However, what is not true is that as an act of environmentalism, you should not have meat. I believe that people may make an ethical choice not to have meat, which is perfectly logical given certain ethical starting points. They may make a health decision not to have meat, which is also perfectly logical. But from an environmental point of view, meat performs an important function if only because you only get meat from animals, and animals perform an important function in sustainable agriculture. Because without livestock, you don't have poo. Without poo, you don't have compost that can become the basis of fertilizer. So then you have to use fossil fuel. And especially when you're talking about a climate such as Canada's, meat and dairy products are part of having adequate food for the year-round without doing a heavy import for your calories or your protein. So the answer, therefore, I think from an environmental point of view, I'm not speaking to the ethics question or to the health question, both of which call for very drastic reductions of meat. But from an environmental point of view, in other words, there is no simple cure, go off meat and we'll solve the problem. It's more a nuanced kind of thing. So, you've sometimes heard the phrase, well, sustainability is not an end, it is a journey. So that's my photo for that. And the other is that, as this photo illustrates, you need to adapt your solution to the scale of the problem. And so bicycles and tricycles are good relative to cars from many points of view, but not necessarily good in the middle of intensive traffic. And the Zapatistas, who I much admire, I think that they have some of the maturity that's needed in the environmental movement that's developing. You may have heard the slogan from Margaret Thatcher, the very conservative Prime Minister of England in the 1970s, said, "There is no alternative to the market," to which people on the left responded in the 1990s, "There is an alternative," and to which the Zapatista responded more recently, "Many alternatives are possible," or "Many worlds are possible." And so that's, I believe, the understanding that goes with seeing food as a major vehicle of change and a major way to affect improvements in society. The concept of no tolerance, in my opinion, is very logically applied to certain categories of action. So you might say zero tolerance for racist comments, zero tolerance for drinking and driving, zero tolerance for child abuse, wife abuse, any number of things. But food, in my opinion, is not an area where the zero tolerance mentality belongs. It's an area where we're going to be working through problems with a wide variety of people. And in the environmental movement, there is often an attitude, I say this as a person who's been arrested in environmental causes and attached to environmental causes for a long period of time, but there is often an attitude which is sometimes expressed as the perfect is the enemy of the good. I'm not going to take the one cafeteria or the one student eatery in McMaster as being anywhere near a decent response to the problem of global warming, and we're going to demand that the whole thing go not 10%, not 15%, not 20%, it's got to go 100% local and green. That's what you would call the perfect is the enemy of the good, so you're going to actually make change impossible instead of introducing it. And I believe the approach of the proper approach for environmentalists in food is the same as the approach used by the Japanese in manufacturing, which is called Kaizen or continuous improvement. You start with 10%. That's what Local Food Plus did at the University of Toronto. The first year of their contract was 10% local and sustainable. You actually got to be almost brain dead not to be able to do that. Like you don't, you know, you'll buy an apple from Washington, D.C. or China in September, right? or you'll buy a strawberry from California in June. I'm not saying a lot of people don't qualify for that test of brain deadness, but all you have to do is to really be awake and watching, and you can avoid it. Second year, 15%. This year is the third year. They're at 20%. And that's the concept of continuous improvement. And I believe that's sort of the future where things are. So I got some more slides on Mexico and chocolate if you're interested, but I'm going to first open it up for questions. Thank you very much.